Okay, I've repeated over here an advertisement that Miguel and Ed mentioned this morning for this Apples with Apples project. There's a website that you can learn more about the project, and there's also a manuscript describing the project that was just submitted to GRQC. It's a community resource designed to provide a whole series of tests that people can see for various codes, so people can learn from each other on how their code is performing relative to other codes on certain test problems. The first round of test problems was problems without boundaries, basically problems with periodic boundary conditions, which is equivalent to running on a three torus. The next round of tests will be grid boundaries, which is the subject of the talk I'm going to give today. And let me just mention that there'll be an organizational meeting for this project tomorrow in this room at 10 o'clock. And everyone's invited. This is a community project, and up to now it's been pretty much self-organizing. Okay, so this is the title of my talk, and what it involves is what mathematicians call the initial boundary value problem. So what I'm going to talk about is the initial boundary value problem for general relativity. And it consists of two pieces. Well, first of all, you take the Einstein equations, and you do the usual thing. You break them up into two parts. One part is the evolution equations that you solve in order to evolve the system. And then the other part are some leftover constraints which have to be satisfied in order for the Einstein tensor to be vanish. So this is the standard reduction of the Einstein tensor into an evolution part and a constraint part. And then the initial boundary value problem consists of solving these two sets of equations in this region between some initial Cauchy hypersurface, which would be space-like, and this outer boundary in this case, which is going to always be time-like. And in the Cauchy problem, what you do is you give your Cauchy data here, and you evolve through its domain of dependence, which would be this lower triangular region in the diagram. And I'll assume throughout my talk that we're dealing with a formalism for which there's nothing wrong with the Cauchy problem, that everything's well posed, and that you can write a good code based upon the formulation, and the code has no problems. And what I want to talk about is the extension now of the evolution into this joint domain of dependence of the initial Cauchy hypersurface and the boundary, where you're given some extra data that determines what the solution is doing up in this region D2. And the main question that you want to ask is, if nothing's wrong with the Cauchy problem, what can go wrong with this initial boundary value problem? What can go wrong in this region D2? And there are three sources of problems. One is a mathematical problems that your Cauchy problem may be well posed, but your initial boundary value problem isn't well posed, in which case you don't have a chance numerically, because being not well posed means that an arbitrarily small perturbation can grow at an arbitrarily fast rate. Another source of difficulty, even if your evolution system is well posed, this part of the problem may come out perfect, but the constraints won't be satisfied in the region D2. In which case, it doesn't matter that you have a nice solution, because it's not a solution of Einstein's equations. And then even if none of these mathematical problems arise, you can still run into numerical problems due to your finite difference method being unstable. And if all that's okay, then you can still run into physical problems due to the fact that you didn't put the right boundary data on the system, so that, for instance, waveforms, you try to get out of the system just don't make any sense, because the boundary data is pumping in a lot of incoming radiation, and so you can't extract a waveform. Now the bottom line is really getting out the waveform, and so at the bottom line is this physical problem. But I don't want to talk further about that today, because the showstoppers right now are at these two levels, that things seem to go wrong at the mathematical and or numerical level, which are hard to separate. And these are the and these seem to be the present impasses in constructing good numerical codes. Now the initial boundary value problem isn't a pretty geometrical problem like the Cauchy problem. The Cauchy problem you can put in a nice geometrical form. This hasn't been done, at least not up to now, for the initial boundary value problem. And the details of how you want to treat the problem really depend upon your system. How you break the Einstein tensor up into an evolution equations and constraint equations, and also what gauge you're using. And let me just give one simple example of how we might extend the Cauchy solution from the region D1 into the region D2. And this has to do with the method of introducing a null gauge. The boundary of the Cauchy region is always going to be some null hypersurface. And we can imagine, so the boundary of the Cauchy domain of dependence is this null hypersurface, and we can imagine using some foliation of the boundary and to induce some family of null hypersurfaces. So we've introduced some null coordinate system in this domain D2 that we want to extend the solution to. And now we can just introduce the standard techniques of characteristic evolution, introduce some break up the metric into some null tetrad, and decompose the Einstein tensor into an evolution system consisting of the ingoing null component of the Einstein tensor and these, what are essentially this M vector is the transverse direction, and this is the traceless trace-free components of the Einstein tensor. So we take this to be our evolution system, and Luis in his talk showed how this the equations underlying this is just the Bondi-Sachs equations, and then the constraints that have to be satisfied in order for the full Einstein tensor to vanish have to do with projecting the Einstein tensor into the one index into the normal to the boundary, and the other index you project tangentially to the boundary. And so there are three constraints that have to be satisfied for this system in addition to these evolution equations. And the remarkable thing about the characteristic initial value problem is that there's very strong control over the constraint propagation. Even if the constraints are violated on this boundary, the violation doesn't grow as you leave the boundary at a very strong rate. In fact, if you go out, if you leave the boundary in a direction heading toward infinity, so the null hypersurfaces are expanding, the constraint violation goes down, and it's sort of self-correcting. And even if you go in a collapsing direction where R is getting smaller, so you're heading toward a caustic, as long as you don't get too close to the caustic, the constraint violation doesn't grow at a very strong rate, just as a power law in 1 over R. And as a result, you can build a very robust code, and there exists a very robust code based upon this system that has no problems with instabilities or constraint violation. And whether this system is well posed is an open question, but it shows that at least as far as building codes go, it suggests that one of the things you want to be able to do in order to have a successful code is to gain good control over the constraints. because that seems to be the advantage of that characteristic evolution has over Cauchy evolution. Now, what I'm really going to talk about is Cauchy evolution. And so let me just talk about the simplest case of Cauchy evolution, where we talk about the initial boundary value problem for just a scalar field satisfying the wave equation, but the wave equation on a curved space background. So we have an arbitrary metric here controlling the wave operator. And so what we're doing now, we give Cauchy data here and some boundary data here for the scalar field. And the first question we want to ask, how do we do that in a well-posed way? Well, we all know how to do that for the Cauchy data. What do you do for the boundary? What do you give as boundary data? And the key behind that is to get control of the energy of the system. And for this simpler system, controlling the energy amounts to looking at the energy flux going across the boundary. And that's given in terms of taking this is the stress energy tensor of the scalar field. And what you do is you hit one component of the stress energy tensor with the time direction that you're doing your evolution. And then you hit the other component with the normal to the boundary in order to calculate how much energy is flowing across the boundary. And when you do that for a scalar field stress energy tensor, you get the product of these two terms. And the key to a well-posed boundary condition is to give boundary data so that this flux is not negative on the boundary. It's either positive or zero. And there's some obvious ways that you could do that. One way you could do it is just make the first term in the product vanish, which is the analog of giving Dirichlet conditions. Once you know the initial value of phi from your initial data, this just says that phi is independent of time as you move up the boundary. So it determines the value of phi on the boundary. And I'll refer to this as a homogeneous Dirichlet boundary condition. We're setting this boundary data equal to zero in order to satisfy that what's called a dissipative condition on the flux. Another way to satisfy it is to give what's called homogeneous Neumann boundary condition. And you set the second term in the product equal to zero. And that again gives a moduli dissipative condition. Both the Dirichlet condition and the Neumann conditions are conditions in which the flux vanishes. And then in between those conditions, what you can do is relate this time derivative of phi to its normal derivative. And if we do it in some way like this, then it becomes what is known as a Sommerfeld-type boundary condition, or a homogeneous Sommerfeld condition, because we have a zero on the right-hand side. And this condition again will be dissipative with a positive flux. And it's the kind of condition that really is amenable to running successful codes, because the positive flux means essentially that a lot of noise has a chance of flowing through the boundary and getting out of your grid. So all these conditions and lots more will work for the this simple scalar field. Notice that unlike the Cauchy problem, where you give two pieces of data, phi and its time derivative, on the boundary you only give one piece of data. You can give this, but you can't give two things. That lead to a ill-posed boundary value problem. Okay, so this is what you do for homogeneous data, and homogeneous data isn't always what you want to pick, because essentially the homogeneous data, homogeneous Neumann or Dirichlet data, would always create a reflecting boundary. But you could give homogeneous data in which a wave here just passed cleanly through the boundary, even with a Dirichlet boundary condition, if you set your Dirichlet data to the right boundary values. So I can just take a pulse here and let it pass through the boundary with Dirichlet data by giving the right Dirichlet boundary data, or I could do the same thing with Neumann data. And the extension of the well-posedness from this homogeneous case to the case of inhomogeneous boundary data for systems like this just goes through by standard techniques. So once you've established well-posedness for the problem with homogeneous data, then standard techniques extend it to well-posedness for inhomogeneous data.
How much? Reflected back
to the, well, that depends on the problem, yeah, and the shape of the boundary. So a Sommerfeld condition is never, except in very special cases, a perfectly transmitting condition. Okay, we want to do this for Einstein's equations now, and so let me just start out with a simple case where I can do everything just like I did for the scalar field, and just do this for the linearized Einstein's equations in a harmonic gauge. So I perturb the Minkowski, the standard Minkowski metric. I introduce the densitized perturbation, and then the evolution set. Then what I can take as the evolution system is these six wave equations based upon the spatial components of this densitized metric Mij. Plus, these equations tell me how to evolve the spatial components of gamma. And now I have to worry about how to evolve the time components of gamma, but I can evolve those by the harmonic conditions themselves. Harmonic conditions are just these divergence conditions, which is another way of saying that in linear approximation, your coordinates satisfy the wave equation. And these conditions can be just thought of as some ODEs that propagate the time components of gamma in time, so that this system is just a well-posed system. It consists of where it consists of just wave equations. We already described how to give boundary data, plus these ODEs, where no extra boundary data is given is necessary because things just propagate up the boundary. And then you have to just worry about the satisfying constraints. The constraints in the system is just that those gammas obey the wave equation, and that can be arranged by the proper choice of initial Cauchy data. So this is a simple example where the initial boundary value problem is well posed in lots of ways. You can give free Dirichlet, Sommerfeld, or Neumann boundary data just like we did for the scalar field, and everything just goes through beautifully. And you can write an evolution code based upon this, and the evolution code will work beautifully. The bad news is that nothing like this generalizes to the nonlinear case. No one knows how to write a system in the nonlinear case which is well posed in a complete sense, in which you can give free Dirichlet, Sommerfeld, or Neumann boundary data unless you include other variables in the system. So there's no system in which the evolution variables are just based upon the metric, in which you can do this in the nonlinear case. If there was a way to extend this to the nonlinear case, then life would be beautiful. The problem is that in the linear case, you have this special decoupling basically between the lapse and the shift and the spatial components of the gamma that doesn't occur in the nonlinear case. And there's been recently a lot of recognition of the problems in formulating proper boundary conditions for general relativity, and I'm just giving here some of the recent literature on this. Most of it is literature regarding linearized approximations. Real seminal work here is for the nonlinear case is the work of Friedrich and Nagy, where they were able to formulate the only complete version for a nonlinear system which is well posed and which allows this freedom that I described before, or the analog of this freedom of giving your data either freely in Dirichlet, Neumann, or Sommerfeld form. So this Friedrich Nagy system, it does exactly what you would like a formulation to do, but on the other hand, it's a rather complicated system because it's first of all, it's a frame system, not based upon the metric. The evolution variables are the frame, the connection, and the vowel tensor. And it seems like if you want to really do something like this, it may be that you have to include the vowel tensor as one of your evolution variables. No one has tried to code this system. It'd be interested to see whether you could actually make a code out of it. It might require some modifications, because in order to prove theorems, you introduce gauge conditions that you might not want to, that might tie your hands behind your back to make a useful code out of it. It's not clear. What I want to talk about in the rest of this talk is a poor man's version of trying to do what Friedrich and Nagy did, which is based upon the Cauchy problem and harmonic coordinates. And this goes back to the first proof of well-posedness of Einstein equations by Brihá, and in the first order form, symmetric hyperbolic form, by Fisher and Marsden, where what we've done is try to extend this using these recent techniques by Seki that allow you to establish well-posedness for the initial boundary nonlinear initial boundary value problems where the boundaries have characteristics in them. And most formulations of general relativity, these boundaries do have characteristics because you're introducing these artificial characteristics by reducing down to the first order symmetric hyperbolic form. Okay, so here's the system. It's basically all this is in Fock's book that no one probably reads anymore. You use the densitized metric as your variable, and then the evolution system, just in harmonic coordinates, just reduces down to 10 wave equations now. This is different than this linearized system. So now I have to make, to go to the nonlinear case, I have to make all 10 components satisfy the wave equation. But that's no problem. This evolution system is still well posed, and so this reduced problem can take any boundary condition, Dirichlet, Sommerfeld, or Neumann, and just work perfectly. So there's no problem evolving this system with a boundary. The problem is evolving this system with a boundary and satisfying Einstein's equations, because Einstein's equations only be satisfied if, in addition, these harmonic conditions are satisfied. Now, you don't have to set the harmonic condition to zero. You can set it equal to some what's called gauge source function, or some term that drives the harmonic gauge. But and that's important because that allows this approach to be applied to any space-time. But just for brevity in writing down equations, I'll assume that these gauge source functions vanish, but everything goes through exactly the same way if they didn't vanish. Okay, so what we want to show now is that these harmonic constraints vanish, and the technique behind doing that is to first note that because of these reduced equations, these constraints themselves satisfy this type of homogeneous wave equation. So the constraints will vanish if we can put on, but because this equation now is a unique solution, if we can put on a dissipative boundary condition, the constraints will vanish if we can just put on some dissipative boundary condition like a Dirichlet condition at the boundary. So all we would have to do is to make the constraints vanish at the boundary, and then we're all through. But this is not as easy as it looks. And just for simplicity, let me take the boundary to be at z equal to 0, and we'll introduce this 3 plus 1 decomposition, where now the 1 is space and the 3 is time and two space coordinates. Then the harmonic constraints correspond to these two equations, one for the normal component of the constraint, and the other for the tangential components of the constraint. And one of the things you can see about these equations is that the term gamma AZ appears in both sets. But in one set, it appears in the Dirichlet form, where this gamma AZ only gets differentiated tangential to the boundary, so it's completely determined by so it's related to Dirichlet data. This gamma AZ gets differentiated in the normal direction, so it's related to Neumann data. And if you try to do the naive thing, you set every term in these equations to zero at the boundary in order to satisfy the harmonic constraints, you'd end up with an inconsistency. You would end up with trying to give both Neumann and Dirichlet type data for the same variable and end up with one of these improperly posed problems. And there doesn't seem to be any way around this, even if you try to be clever, in order to impose data on the gammas such that the harmonic conditions will vanish on the boundary. So this isn't as easy as it seems, but there's a way to do it. And the trick behind it is not to try to make, not to introduce dissipative conditions on all components of Dirichlet conditions on all components of H. We just do it on the normal component, and then require that the tangential components of H satisfy Neumann conditions. So these conditions are still dissipative, and if they're satisfied, the solution will then have to satisfy the constraints. And what you find is that these conditions will be satisfied, providing that you impose these homogeneous conditions on the metric, or the densitized metric. So you impose on the mixed tangential normal components this homogeneous Dirichlet condition, and then on all the remaining components, you put on these homogeneous Neumann conditions, and then automatically, this will be satisfied. So this then guarantees that this problem with these homogeneous boundary conditions is well posed and satisfies the Einstein equations. Solutions will satisfy the Einstein equations.
Isn't there a step where you show that the reduced equations preserve the initial value constraints and the harmonic conditions as they propagate?
I'm skipping all the steps that are part of the standard Cauchy. As I said, I'm assuming everything's okay with the initialization of the system and the Cauchy. Okay, so that's why I'm. You're right, but I'm just. You have to make sure all the proper things are done on the initial surface. But that's the thing that is an old solved problem. Okay, so this is terrific, except that you want to be able to do this with inhomogeneous data as well as homogeneous data. And the problem is that you could do this for the reduced system with the inhomogeneous data just by the standard tricks, but the standard tricks break down when you try to satisfy these constraints on the boundary. So that even though the homogeneous problem is well posed, the inhomogeneous problem is only well posed for boundary data that can be thought of as a small perturbation of the homogeneous problem. So you're essentially linearizing your boundary data off a homogeneous solution. Also note that the choice that works is just marginally dissipative. These are just Dirichlet and Neumann conditions, and no one's figured out a way in a metric-based formalism, even in the linearized theory, except the one that I showed you, in which you can do Sommerfeld type boundary conditions. So, this is a real disadvantage for numerical evolution, because these are very delicate boundary type boundary conditions to evolve stably. Okay, so let me go to now to the inhomogeneous case. This one here? I'll come back to that. So let me go on now to the inhomogeneous case in which some of the meaning will crop up. First of all, there's some harmonic gauge freedom that has to do with how you exactly what harmonic coordinates you pick, and this tells you the freedom on how you can give inhomogeneous data for these mixed tangential normal components, which basically are like to the boundary what the shift is to a Cauchy evolution. So these are like pure gauge pieces that you can control by your choice of harmonic coordinates. And so this piece can be given freely. Note that doesn't determine the data that you want on the right-hand side here directly, but only given this free pot. It only determines it directly if you knew gamma zz, and you don't know gamma zz at the boundary. You know, the thing that you want to give for a well-posed problem is the normal derivative. So this is all part of the perverse nature of this problem. When you go to the inhomogeneous case, there are things you need, but you don't know them until the evolution is carried out. And this is why, this is not an easy problem. Also, once you set this thing non-equal to zero, so you have this boundary version of a shift, the normal derivative becomes more complicated. It's not just the z derivative, but it includes some combination of time and xy derivatives, if you think of t, x, and y being the coordinates of your boundary. So what you mean by a normal derivative is more complicated, and so what you mean by Neumann data is more complicated. But yet, Neumann data for the ZZ component of the metric still ends up being determined in a rather simple way. The inhomogeneous Neumann data, if you just plug into this harmonic boundary constraint, ends up being just determined in terms of these QAs by a simple equation. So nothing very difficult enters here, except this disturbing thing that you don't really have theorems that say this problem is well posed in the case of strongly nonlinear boundary data. Now you have to worry about what are you going to give for the remaining things. That takes care of the boundary data for these two quantities. What about the Neumann data for these parts of the metric intrinsic to the boundary? Well, that's like a normal derivative of the metric, and you know that that's related to the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. So this extra boundary data that you want to give is somehow giving some data about the extrinsic curvature of the boundary, and this condition that the normal derivative of the harmonic condition vanish at the boundary is a condition very similar to the not usual constraint equation. This would be the usual constraint equation governing the momenta, except now that these are the boundary versions of the momenta. These are extrinsic curvature of boundary. And the only extra thing that it gets involved here are other components of the constraint. And this is the equation that has to be satisfied in order to give the remaining data. Now, the principal part of this equation is right in these terms over here, and you all recall that those terms basically are elliptic type terms for the Cauchy problem, where you're looking at them on a space-like hypersurface. But now we're looking at them on a time-like boundary, and these equations now become hyperbolic equations, and in fact, you can show they form. That's what I have left. You can show they form a symmetric hyperbolic system that determines three components of these quantities in terms of three components that you can give freely. So that you can actually solve these, but they have to be solving these system has to be part of your code. on the boundary, you have to solve these three-dimensional equations as you're evolving in order to determine the proper data. And if you do that, then what you find is that any solution of your reduced equations with this boundary data has to satisfy the constraints. So that's the good news, is that you know that the constraints will be satisfied. The question is the problem well posed? That's another question. But if you do find a solution, you know it's a solution of Einstein's equations now. Okay, so now you have to come, you want to actually make a code based upon all of this, and so you have to go through the usual difficult choices of how you're going to design a code. And here are just some of the things you have to decide between. Are you going to go to first order in time derivatives, in space derivatives, or second order? And we'd rather do everything as basically we're evolving wave equations, and so we'd like to do it in second differential form. But when you have a lapse in your metric, there is no known algorithm, as far as I know, that's very good for doing the wave equation in second order form. So what we do is we do it in second order form in space. These actually were reversed in the on the transparency. So we do it in second order in space, but we go to first order in time just because we don't know a good second order algorithm for the time derivatives when there's a lapse. Then you have to ask, well, what's the shape of the boundary? I've been just talking about a little piece of the boundary up to now. You have to decide how you make a closed boundary, and you can either take it to be a sphere or a cube, for instance. And the advantage of a sphere is that it's smooth, and none of the well-posedness theorems work or apply to non-smooth boundaries. So it's just an open question whether once you have a non-smooth boundary, whether your system will remain well-posed. But on the other hand, when you're dealing with Cartesian grids, spherical boundaries are a pain in the neck. And so it's tremendously easier to use a cubic boundary, and so we choose a cubic boundary. All these things are subject to change, but you have to make a decision. Then there are some other decisions that aren't as hard to make. You want a general boundary gauge, or you want to set this boundary gauge terms to zero. Or do you want harmonic forcing terms, or you want to set the harmonic forcing terms to zero? And we'd rather stick, at least at first, with the more flexible cases, because that doesn't tie your hands behind your back in simulating an arbitrary system. And then you have a question, well, how much accuracy do you want? And if you look at the theorems regarding well-posedness, one of the strange things about them is that the amount of differentiability you're guaranteed in the direction normal to the boundary is only half as good as the amount that you're guaranteed tangential to the boundary. And so this ought to be reflected in your numerical stencils in saying that something like, if you're going to have second order accuracy tangentially, then you should only require first order accuracy in the normal direction. And then on top of that, there's the whole usual bag of tricks that you need in order to keep your code stable. So
first order in the normal direction, and second order tangentially rather obvious.
Maybe, yeah. But I mean, but it's obvious. It's yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So we built a code based upon those choices, and it was a very naive code. But still, it ran pretty well. In the linear regime, this is the error growth for a wave of amplitude 10 to the minus 3, and you can see that the error doesn't grow at a very, it just grows at some power law rate. And in the linear regime, there doesn't seem to be any instabilities in the code. If you crank the amplitude up to a tenth, what you find out is that, again, you see the power law increase in the error. And eventually it'll reach some critical stage where nonlinear type instabilities will take over. But the code seems to converge. These are overlays of graphs for two different grid sizes, and in this region they overlay perfectly. And when the coarser grid goes, the finer grid keeps on running for a while and goes at a later time. So this is our first naive attempt at this. And then we went and looked. We weren't completely happy with this because these power law things, even though they're not exponential, still can give you problems. So what we wanted to do was get rid of this power law growth, and we could trace where it was coming from by the way we were handling imposing Neumann boundary conditions for the wave equation. And we found that even for the standard flat space wave equation with the standard Minkowski metric, it's not a simple job to impose Neumann boundary conditions when you have the equation in second order form. And in fact, it was surprising to me that there was just a paper by Kreis, Peterson, and Yström showing how to do this properly for the regular wave equation with the curved boundary, that this was an unresolved problem. And it becomes a much more complicated. The standard way for doing that is to just obtain the what you're given is this Neumann data on the boundary, and you obtain the value of phi at the boundary by shooting along the normal direction, basically by making that Taylor series expansion. Now, when you have a moving boundary in a dynamic spacetime, you can't do that because now the normal direction to the boundary does not lie tangential to your Cauchy height, to your Cauchy slicing. So if you try to, so in this case, if the boundary is moving in relative to your Cauchy slicing, and these moving boundaries are likely to occur in cases where you're trying to do things like go to co-rotating coordinates, then these interpolations involve future time levels. And you can do this. You can make interpolation senses like that, and you get things to run, but they're awfully noisy, especially when you have when you try to treat the corners and edges of a cube. So what we spent most of the last half year doing was just trying to devise good ways of applying Neumann boundary conditions to the scalar waves propagating on a curved space background, and what this is an example of our what our best present technique is, and the space time that you have to imagine this running on is Minkowski space, but in some gauge in which there's a gauge wave moving from that corner of the room up to that corner up there, so it's moving along the diagonal and making the walls oscillate back and forth at about 1/5 the velocity of light, and maybe the walls are moving at about 1/10 of the way across the room. So you have to imagine you're in a frame now in which this room is oscillating back and forth in this horrible way, and then you run another wave starting from that corner back toward this corner in that background and try to simulate it by using Neumann boundary conditions. And so this is a continuous periodic wave running that way, and the room is periodically vibrating in that way. And what you find is that there are methods now that will evolve this system with good accuracy. And you can see that we've overlaid here the numeric and exact solutions after 20 crossing times, and there doesn't seem to be any problems with the system, and there's no problems near the boundary. Okay, so just in summary, the bottom line, as I said, was to compute waveforms from binary black holes. But these basic elementary tests are important in order to make sure that your waveforms can be trusted. And to go back to this advertisement, that's the whole rationale for this Apples with Apples project, is running these tests and establishing some repository for the community to look to see what different codes can do. Thank you.
I'm trying to guess the answer to what Jimmy asked you, and I think his question was, is it natural from the physical point of view, or is it obvious that you have to use some finite difference at the boundary that is first order in the normal direction and second in the transversal? And I don't know what your motivation is or your answer would be, but I'm trying to I'll try to guess. And so he mentioned that for...
Well, he just used a case from electromagnetic theory, I guess.
When you have characteristic boundaries, say, when you have characteristic boundaries, you have zero speed mostly. In the usual case, when you have the zero shift, then these theorems of existence and uniqueness of the initial boundary value problem, this theorem by Secchi, he's able to show that the solution is twice as smooth in the transversal direction compared to the normal direction. So if it has two derivatives in the transversal direction, it has only one in the normal direction. Now, if you use a difference operator at the boundary, it has the same accuracy in both directions, normal and transversal. That difference operator, in order to be reasonable, so the truncation error depends on the derivative. And if they have the same accuracy, you're assuming that both of them, say, have three derivatives, which is in general not true. However, if you use a finite difference at the boundary, it's first order only in the normal direction, then if the solution has two derivatives, the truncation error is finite and you're done. While in the transversal direction, you can use a second order, say, the different scheme. And then, by this theorem, if you had two derivatives in the normal direction, you will have four in the transversal. So the truncation error depends on the derivative, and you always have more derivatives in transversal direction than in normal. Yeah.
Okay, maybe we should check our speaker again.